In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Ramada Hotel, featuring a heated indoor pool, in-room high-speed internet access, in-room microwaves and refrigerators, a continental breakfast bar, and jacuzzi suites. The Ramada is located off I-74 and North Lincoln Avenue in Urbana.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. This afternoon, listeners, I invite your questions for veterinarian Julia Whittington of the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Whittington can answer questions about wildlife medicine in the Wildlife Medical Clinic at the U of I, and she can also answer questions about caring for our companion animals. If you have a question for Julia Whittington, give us a phone call. She will try to help. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Welcome. Good to see you.
Nice to see you also.
Lots of folks in Champaign-Urbana are talking turkey.
Yeah, they sure are.
About the turkeys that are in town. But listeners elsewhere in our coverage area might not know what we're talking about these turkeys. Would you tell us about our urban turkeys?
I think we had our first report of these turkeys last summer when we got a call in at the wildlife clinic from a homeowner who wondered if this was normal to be seeing a hen with some baby turkeys and wanting to know if, in fact, they should be staying there. And at that point, we decided that, you know, these probably were wild turkeys. We didn't know any better at that point. And so they stayed. It's actually illegal to relocate, pick up, keep, transport any migratory wild birds. So they stayed there. And then this spring, we started getting more turkey reports. And I suspect they were the same turkeys. But these turkeys, whether they are wild or domestic, they certainly have become domesticated.
Yeah, they're city dwellers now.
They are.
Yeah, and they're causing a few problems.
Just a few.
Yeah. How many are there?
My understanding is that there were four, but as of late, the turkey sightings have only reported three. The two males tend to hang out together. They're buds, and they travel all over the city. But the hen, at least this spring, seems to be roosting somewhere. Whether that means she's sitting on a nest or not, I don't know.
Yeah. Now, what do you call a turkey chick?
A turkey chick.
A baby. You know what I mean.
Yeah. Chicks. They're basically
chicks. Yeah. Okay.
Obviously, adult males are toms. And my understanding is that these juvenile males are called jakes. And then you've got the hens.
The hen. Okay. And have there been any sightings of any nesting behavior?
No, not at this point. Not that anybody has reported.
Yeah. But
I understand the female likes to hang out behind the president's house at the university. It's a really nice garden area, you know. It's a good place for a house.
Yeah. Now the plan is to round them up, mm-hmm. capture them, and to release them in a more appropriate environment.
Yeah. There are certainly several concerns with having feral turkeys around, and certainly for their safety, they're too tame. They're not afraid of people. They're not afraid of vehicles. And we had a report that one had been injured a couple weeks ago, although she was never located. So certainly, you know, you're going to have that sort of interaction, and it's not always going to be a win-win situation. Then because they have no fear of people, they have been known to decide that they wanted the entire sidewalk and shoot people off or tried to bite at people as they passed.
Yeah. Now, I understand your true wild turkeys in the wild also can be aggressive if you get in there.
Actually, any wild animal is going to have the ability and the desire to protect its offspring, protect its territory, protect itself. But turkeys certainly can be intimidating because of their size and their strength.
Yeah. What kind of range does a turkey need?
You You know, that's a good question, and I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that. These guys seem to range between Ray Street and 4th Street, so a pretty big area. And since nothing seems to be holding them in, I would assume that that would be typical of their normal range size.
Yeah. Now, given that they're living in an urban area now, will they be able to make it in the wild?
My understanding at this point is that the powers that be do not want them released into the wild for a couple of reasons. One, they probably wouldn't be able to fend for themselves well. Another is that if they are of domestic stock, they don't want them to interbreed with wild turkeys and change that species genetics. So the goal at this point is to capture them up and place them in sort of halfway houses, really, you know, good protected areas.
Yeah. This time of year is a time of year when we see all kinds of wonderful bird behavior and other animals, birds nesting and laying eggs. You know, it's really a lot of fun to watch them. And other animals are also giving birth and raising offspring. And sometimes, you know, we see a tiny little animal and we think, gee, is it okay? When is intervening the right thing to do, and when should we leave things as they are?
That's a really good question, and it's something that we encounter quite a bit. If you think about a cottontail rabbit, you know, your basic rabbit, when these animals, when their offspring are on their own, they're only about 3.5 inches long, and they're pretty much helpless. But they're on their own because the mom's probably already started, you know, her next litter. So if you see an animal on the ground and it is moving, it's active, it's, you know, seemingly healthy, then frankly, the best thing to do is to leave it alone. If you see a mammal that has its eyes closed or is furless, or you see baby birds who are on the ground and, you know, obviously they don't have flight feathers, then those are animals that have been displaced from nests. And the best thing to do is to find the nesting location and put them back. You can certainly touch them. The parents will not reject them. You'd want to wash your hands for your own safety and health. But these animals will be taken back under the parental care, and Mother Nature is by far and away the best provider for these guys.
Yeah. What if you're not sure if there's, you know, a bigger problem and you would need to call somebody for some advice? Can you call the wildlife clinic, or who else can you call?
You can certainly call the wildlife clinic. We are very much dependent on student volunteerism, and the students are taking their finals. So if you don't get somebody in the clinic, leave a message. We'll get back to you as soon as we can. Other resources for the public would include animal control as well as the Department of Natural Resources, and both of those sources have good information for people. If you do find baby animals that obviously do need medical care, don't even bother calling. Just bring them to us. We're located at the College of Veterinary Medicine off of Lincoln Avenue. We have people there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we'll provide care for those animals free of charge. If they seem to be healthy, then really getting those animals to a wildlife licensed rehabilitator would be best.
Okay. How long does it take a young bird to fledge?
Depends on the species. Uh-huh. Great horned owls were nesting in January of this year, and just now some of them are branchers, which means that they're emerging out of the nest and they're starting to stand beside the nest. But they won't fledge for another month and a half. Some of the songbirds who are nesting now, they'll be raising their offspring, and they'll be out of the nest within about 30 to 40 days. So if you have a nest that's not in the best place, I think the swallows love to make those nests on your porch light.
Yeah.
You know? If you have one of those, then just give it a little time. They'll be out of there soon, and then you can knock it down.
Okay, and leave the light off.
Yeah,
that's seriously, yeah, you can have a fire.
Get pretty hot there.
Yeah, so, and you might want to just look around the house. We've got some sparrows. I don't know what they're up to, but they're up to something. There's a pair, and they've been kind of a little on the aggressive side, actually. I've come out on the front porch, and I've got a fern hanging there, and one of them is like, oh, this looks good. And I also came out one day, and there was the sparrow on the wreath that we have hanging on the front porch. And it was like, they were like what are you doing here? This is our territory. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of gently shoo them away.
So yeah, they're busy.
Yeah,
and they're persistent.
And they're determined.
Sure.
They got a job to do. But so far we haven't seen, beside the owl that you mentioned, mm-hmm. are there other species that have eggs? Have
oh, yeah. Mourning doves are nesting babes. In the cardinals are nesting in the robins are nesting. And of course, the sparrows, red-winged blackbirds are nesting. So lots. And of course, the geese, you know, you see them all over the place. Swans. In the wildlife clinic, we have obvious seasons for wild animals. And the first ones we see showing up are the squirrels. They tend to start early. And so we've got baby squirrels and the baby raccoons and the baby cottontails are going to be coming. And then the songbirds show up. So it's a progression. And we know spring is here.
Yeah, yeah. What happens when an animal is admitted?
Well, the first thing that happens is the animal will receive a physical exam. And just like would happen if you went to the emergency room, that animal is going to be triaged. We address any immediate concerns, whether it's bleeding or it's in shock. Because we're dealing with wild animals, the unfortunate fact is that these animals have to be able to survive in the wild. So if they present for an illness or an injury that would prevent them from ever returning back to the wild, then we do humanely euthanize them because we're not doing them any good to make them suffer along and then die in captivity. So if it looks like the animal has an injury or an illness that we can take care of, then they get admitted to the clinic. Veterinary students, extremely dedicated group of people, take over the care of that animal under my direction, and we do diagnostic testing just as they would for a human, drawing blood, doing x-rays, things along those lines. Then care is provided, and then they're released.
What do you see most often, injury or illness?
Definitely injury.
Yeah.
Certainly we see infectious disease and illness. West Nile, of course, is a big one, and who knows if we'll get avian influenza. The number one cause of presentation of animals to the wildlife clinic is some sort of interaction with the person where the animal lost.
Yeah. What kind of cases have you seen recently at the clinic that have been unusual or really interesting or have, you know, stumped the students, given you a good run for your money?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really fun to see the students working with the animals because they're learning so much information in their classroom and then they apply it. So it's really a fun process to watch that light go on. And these are people who are going to be your pet's vets, you know, and so it's great training for them. But we had a West Nile great horned owl as early as January this year, which is very unusual for that particular disease. And hopefully that doesn't mean that this season is going to be particularly bad. But we see a fair number of animals with neurological signs. And so the question begs, do they have meningitis or do they have head trauma? Do they have a parasitic infection? So we have a Virginia rail right now who was circling to one side, but she's straightened out and so is going to be released.
Oh, that's great. How often are the animals able to return to the wild?
We have about a 40% release rate, which for a wildlife facility is actually really pretty good. A lot of them, whether it was their injury or illness that caused their death or simply the stress of being in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
While we do everything we can to minimize that stress, it's still a significant problem for them. And so some of them just die in captivity. And then we euthanize a fair number.
Yeah. Let's look on the bright side.
Yeah.
You've treated a patient. It's time for it to be released.
That's the best part.
Yeah. Are there special considerations for release? What's involved for readying mm-hmm. that animal mm-hmm. to go back?
It depends on the species. If it's a bird that will fly or has a migratory flight that they have to really be able to be perfect flyers, then we rely heavily on our wildlife rehabilitators. These are people who are trained and licensed to assess the animal. They have the facilities to really recondition that animal, much like physical therapy. And then that animal will prove that it is releasable. And then we try very hard to get it released back into the area from which it came. It's really nice when we can locate the person who brought us the animal in the first place
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, would you like to be a part of this? We had a red-tailed hawk a couple years ago who was hit by a truck over in Vermilion County. And the guy who brought it into us was a Native American. And he actually coordinated a tribal ceremony on that hawk's release. It was really fun and gratifying to know that that animal was not only benefiting from our care, but was being sent off with such great karma.
You know? Yeah, really. And, you know, another thing, you mentioned that an animal like a bird has to be in tip-top shape in order to leave. Migratory birds are, what they do is just tremendous. We had a guest on a little while ago from the ornithology lab at Cornell, and she talked with us about people who track birds and bird migration. And actually, it was somebody here at the University of Illinois who was in an airplane, and they followed this bird, and they had to land because they ran out of gas before they ran out of fuel before the bird did. Mm-hmm. So it really is quite a feat.
Yeah, it's amazing. Some of our most challenging cases are the fall migratory birds who end up injured. Like we had a white pelican who ran into some sort of power line, injured. Fortunately, didn't fracture anything because you've got this migratory window. We get in hummingbirds on their fall migration. And if they have a fracture and they miss that migratory window, then we need to contact one of the airlines to fly them down because they're just not going to be able to make it. It's a challenge.
Wow. I never thought of that, but yeah.
Yeah, they can't fly in February.
No.
They get grounded.
No, got to put them on a flight.
Yeah.
How is the clinic funded? How do you pay for this?
Well, we have our operating budget is mostly expenses related to animal care. So we're able to keep our overhead to a minimum. The college provides us with the space that we operate out of, but everything else we raise. We depend on donations and gifts and grants and all the different things that any not-for-profit organization depends on. And it's a struggle, but it's an important one. We provide, I feel, a really, really unique service to the community. The look on some of the kids' faces when they bring you that animal and they know that they've helped. We also work really hard to try to get out to local schools and clubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, and really talk to them about not just the animals we care for, but how did those animals get there and the fact that human-related activities often, you know, end up in negatively impacting those animals. So hopefully by contacting those kids early, they're going to learn in messages about caring for the environment. And that's really important component of what we do.
Speaking of kids, there's a big party coming up. Is it Saturday, the Pet Extravaganza?
There is. I understand that's going to be at the Stock Pavilion. We'll have a booth there. But lots of fun animal information there, and I believe it's open to the public.
Yeah, it is. There have been ads in the paper, and I'm sure that if you go and visit the website for the College of Veterinary Medicine and get all the information. Mm-hmm. Also, another event coming up, speaking of fundraising, you've got your
Doodle for Wildlife.
Doodle for Wildlife.
And I tell you that I didn't come up with the name of this event, but every time I say doodle, it sort of brings up this image. But actually what Doodle for Wildlife stands for are drawings that have been donated to us by celebrities. We've got quite the list this year of celebrity donations. And then we augment that with lots of great packages and events, exciting events that you wouldn't really have access to otherwise.
So it works like an auction?
It does, yeah. We're having an auction this Saturday from 6 to 10 at the Illini Union. And all of the proceeds go to caring for our wildlife. So it's really important. It's an important event for us because it's about a third of our annual budget.
Do you need a reservation or a ticket or something?
Yeah, the tickets are $50 a piece, and it's helpful for us if you buy one in advance, although they will be available at the door. And certainly you can call the college office at 333-2762, and they'll set you up, and it'll be a really exciting night. We've got some things like a behind-the-scenes tour of Disney's Animal Kingdom Veterinary Hospital, and we've got beautiful little apartment in France for a week and all kinds of fun things.
And what about other things that maybe wouldn't require
such a trip?
Yeah.
We've got, certainly we're going to offer to somebody the chance to come into the wildlife clinic and learn how to handle our resident birds of prey and actually hold them and gest them and hold them on glove. So that's kind of exciting, probably the closest some people will ever get to a red-tailed hawk or a great horned owl. And we've got the Urbana Fire Department that has agreed to host 8 guests at their firehouse for dinner. But you better bring dessert, because otherwise you may be washing the truck or something. And we've got a wonderful experience for Illini fans to get a behind-the-scenes glimpse at the Illini sports facilities. Lots and lots of other things. Okay, and so certainly some of our celebrities like Jack Nicholson and Matthew McConaughey and all kinds of people who have donated.
Who've doodled for
doodle
you.
Doodle for us. That's right.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon, veterinarian Julia Whittington of the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. She's here to answer questions about caring for animals. If you've got questions about wildlife medicine, which is what we've been talking about so far, give us a call. Or perhaps you've got a question about caring for your companion animal. She's happy to help that way as well. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, if it would be a long-distance call, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. We have a listener who wants to speak with you on line one. Caller in Urbana, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I have seen 2 largish birds, sort of the size of geese, and they had iridescent feathers. Would that have been those wild turkeys that have adopted us?
It sure sounds like it. There's not too many birds that would be the size of a Canada goose other than another goose or maybe a swan, but with those iridescent feathers, you're pretty much describing the turkeys.
Ah, okay. Do all turkeys have iridescent feathers or just those in the wild?
Most domestic turkeys that you would think of when you're thinking of Thanksgiving dinner are white. Certainly there are different species, different, I guess you could call them breeds of turkey, but the wild turkeys are just fantastically gorgeous. They've got the beautiful rainbow look to their feathers, and especially the toms when they display are just amazing to look at.
Well, my husband thought they might be peacock hens. Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't heard of any reports of stray peacock hens, and God willing, we won't.
But okay.
We'll have to name them, too.
So it's when you say a halfway house, will that be an enclosed shelter, or will that be, part of a zoo?
Well, my understanding from the Urbana Animal Control folks is that the Department of Natural Resources does really not want them getting out.
Mm-hmm.
So the places that we've located thus far have a lot of private acreage and some large pens, and they already have some turkeys on land. So they're already set up to manage this kind of bird. But, certainly they're not. Both of the places that I've talked to are not in the business of raising turkeys to eat them. They're sort of
just wondered about that.
They're sort of just, for enjoyment.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We've been hearing about the role veterinarians can play in disease surveillance, and you mentioned earlier West Nile virus. Would you talk about that aspect of veterinary medicine?
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And I would say that all veterinarians are on the cutting edge of disease surveillance because, you think about canine influenza that outbroke in Florida, and those veterinarians, that wasn't a disease they'd seen before in dogs. So the fact that it was identified and the appropriate people were notified and then the cause of the illness that they were seeing in these greyhounds was identified as an influenza virus and subsequently learned that it had jumped from an equine strain of influenza. So certainly all veterinarians have to be vigilant about animal diseases, especially foreign animal diseases. And when we think about wildlife, that's even more so the case because For instance, West Nile virus, that was first discovered in North America by the zoo veterinarian in New York. And she found it in a crow that was dead on the grounds. You know, she took it upon herself, as many zoos do, to, you know, really test that animal and discovered this virus. And a lot of the people were saying, no, it can't be.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it was. So wild animals can often be our very first glimpse that there's an emerging problem. Certainly avian influenza, you know, if this virus, and it most likely will come into this country, it will most likely come via one of the migratory bird pathways, where Asian birds or birds over in Europe intermingle with North American species. You know, just because avian influenza comes into this country does not mean we're in the midst of a pandemic by any means. Avian influenza is a virus that's found in wild bird flocks all over all the time. But this particular strain is of concern to us, and so wild birds will be tested and monitored to watch for the emergence of that.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I have a question. When I was in Europe, people were encouraged to shut down their bird feeders during the nesting season because that would keep the parent birds from catching insects for their young. I've never heard anybody here discuss that. Is first place, are European birds different that way, or is it another kind of a folktale?
It's a good question, and I would say that it depends on the species of birds that are visiting the feeder. Most birds who eat insects are not seed eaters, and most seed eaters are not going to be foraging for insects, so I'm not sure that one really impacts the other. I would say that if bird feeders are not maintained well, they can really become large mixing pots for different bacteria and infectious problems that can be transmitted from one bird to another and certainly to the offspring.
Mm-hmm.
So if you maintain a feeder, while it's not a bad idea to do, certainly make sure that you empty it out and clean it thoroughly on a weekly basis. And that would also go for your bird baths.
Sure. So you think it's very species specific?
I do, and I'm not familiar with the European species, but if they're anything like North American species, then I would say that really the seeding birds are not going to be impacting how many insects are taken.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
Well, thanks.
Interesting question. And not only the feeders and the bird baths, but what about the ground underneath? What's the best advice for keeping that kind of tidied up?
Yeah. It's a challenge, certainly because squirrels will be introduced into that whole mix.
Mm-hmm.
If you can simply just rake up any of the debris that sort of accumulates under the feeders and dispose of it, obviously using gloves if you actually come into contact with it, basically personal safety and hygiene are appropriate. But most of the problem is where the birds actually have direct contact with infectious sort of secretions around the feeder. So while the ground may be more of a problem for kids playing under it or you know, just the accumulation of waste, the feeder itself is where the birds will transmit problems from one to another.
Yeah, so at busy times of the year, keep that
thing
really clean. Maybe every time you fill it.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
Take it down, clean it out.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Veterinarian Dr. Julia Whittington is our guest this afternoon here on the program. If you've got a question about animals, you can give us a call, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Dr. Whittington will be happy to help. How about a question about a cat?
Okay.
My husband and I adopted a wonderful cat a couple months back from the shelter. He's 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We got him home and put food down in the same manner we did with a cat we had before him. And rather than just nicely self-feeding, this guy just gulped it all down and then immediately would turn around and be ill.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've done is we're just giving him little bits throughout the day. But we're wondering, you know, over time, do you think we'll be able to increase that so that, you know, somebody who's taking care of him when we're away mm-hmm. wouldn't have to come in six times a day, mm-hmm. you know, or stay there.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can find somebody who's willing to stay, but can we over time gradually increase that and get him used to it's there's going to be food there. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it very much depends on his history and background and his personality. I know some cats who've, you know, been in the lap of luxury their entire life and they still, you know, gorge themselves anytime food's around. But I would say that if he's, you know, simply coming from a background that it was feast or famine, over time, and he realizes that this is a secure environment and that food source is a ready supply, theoretically, he should be able to calm down with that aggressive nature towards food.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, only a couple times a day, maybe.
Yeah.
Two or three times, yeah. That would be great. Yeah. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi. I live in Urbana, and I walk in the mornings, and I had walked several times by the turkeys when there was the mom and the three kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Friday, I saw the two, I believe they're hens, and they chased me mm-hmm. aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, it was right on George Huff and Mumford, which is probably three blocks from Yankee Ridge School,
mm-hmm.
where there's going to be small kids walking mm-hmm. to elementary. My question, I guess, is, if it happens again, what do you do?
It's a good question. And in a normal situation, when you had a turkey or any large bird, let's say a Canada goose or a swan, who was becoming aggressive towards a human because it was defending a nest or defending offspring, then usually if you can get out of the immediate area, they won't pursue you. But the problem with these turkeys is they were raised around people and they have no fear of people.
No.
And, you know, it's just almost, I hate to use the word a game for them, but, you know, they don't have a problem with it. And so I don't know that there's really anything you can do. Certainly trying to get away from the environment may be helpful. I've seen some people, or I personally haven't seen them, but I've had reports of some people who've turned and tried to, you know, scare them back. But they just bit them.
Yeah, I did yell. Like, I've been chased by large dogs,
yeah.
And it was not half as terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I yelled no, and I kind of waved my arm,
mm-hmm.
and they were not even concerned.
Mm-mm.
And, you know, luckily someone saw me and what was happening and picked me up,
mm-hmm.
and they chased the truck.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it's... Like, if it happens again, I mean, it's scary.
Right. Well, the good news is they're slated to be moved.
But they can't catch them because I called the city, and I called, and they said, well, we'll call animal control. And mm-hmm. I knew their exact location.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there.
Yeah. The problem, I've spoken at length with the Urbana Animal Control officer about this problem. And you know, she's done a tremendous job trying to keep them corralled and keep them under control. But the bottom line is she needs to get some professional help with, mm-hmm. with, you know, because she's had people try to come and corral them before, and they're intimidating.
So,
you know, I've spoken to her, and hopefully the two of us will be able to get together a group of people that will be able to handle these guys.
Yeah, because I've walked by them countless times, but that's, again, when the mother, obviously the mother and the three.
Mm-hmm.
And so first starting hearing reports about their aggressive nature, I was thinking they were nuts because mm-hmm. they'd never shown any.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very scary and very aggressive, and I would hate for and they do hang out in the area by the school.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if they get a little kid?
Yeah, well, I would say for the administrators of that school, if the turkeys are around the school, then I personally wouldn't let the kids near them.
Yeah, well, I mean, they chase you. I mean, yeah. If you're just innocently walking down the street, because I'd switch sides
mm-hmm.
to show I was non-aggressive, and when they first charged me, I switched again, mm-hmm. and it was like you said, it was like a game with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And so I just didn't know, I mean, if I'm walking tomorrow and it happens again, if there's a good thing to do.
Under normal circumstances, you bet, but in this case, they're just too tamed.
Okay.
And so the normal fear that a wild animal would have, even an animal that was aggressively coming after you, I mean, they're doing it to protect themselves, a normal animal, you know, and so if you can just simply remove the threat to them, they will back off. These guys, that innate fear of humans has been removed.
Right.
And so you cannot even use logical methods that would work with any other species on them. So.
And here's a dumb question, but I was wearing a bright orange sweatshirt. I was wondering if that would have made them more sensitive or...
Some birds can see really well in color, and I'm not sure if turkeys can. I think more than anything, especially this time of year, whether these guys are breeding or not, they are hormonally stimulated, and so everything is heightened, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that it was so much what you were wearing or if changing what you wore when you were out walking would matter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I just thought maybe you'd have some good advice.
Yeah.
I'm out there every morning, yeah. And I'm a little nervous, I have to admit.
Yeah, you bet, you bet. And you know what? This brings up a really good point that we were talking about earlier. And any time you raise a wild animal or, you know, even an animal that shouldn't be raised in that close proximity to people, you remove that sense of fear. And that goes for raising, you know, those adorable little baby raccoons or cottontail bunny. You know, if you take away the innate fear that they have of people, you create a nuisance. And that's why it's so important for people to not try to raise wild animals on their own.
So do you think they were actually being raised?
Well, I think
they just wandered in.
Yeah, no, I can't imagine. I really have a hard time imagining this hen choosing the middle of an urbana neighborhood to nest. But, you know, it's possible.
Because we've had skunks and, you know, things you wouldn't think would hang out in our neighborhood.
Right.
But they're there.
Yeah. It's possible, but, you know, more likely they were raised and released.
Oh, okay.
They're feral.
Okay, well, I was just, because, I mean, it was a scene out of Jurassic Park, I'm telling you.
I'm sorry.
So I just thought maybe you'd have the world's best advice if it happened again.
Well, I think the world's best advice is that we need to put them in a safe someplace else.
Yeah. Have they ever found the third one?
I don't believe so. Now, the one that they had reported was injured, and I get this information from the Urbana Animal Control Officer. Initial reports said that it was brought to the wildlife clinic, but while we did get in a turkey at that point, it was not that turkey. It was from a rural community elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that she was ever found.
Oh, so and what about the fourth? Is it true that one was put down?
No, well, a turkey was euthanized by us, but not one of these turkeys.
Oh, because they're definitely separated now, then.
Yeah, yeah. From what I understand, the remaining three sort of get together in the morning over near the president's house.
Okay.
And then the two sort of head off by themselves, and the one stays by herself over in that area somewhere.
Oh, so it's the boy that's missing.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I haven't had a turkey sighting myself.
I've had many. So, and you could tell it was a mom and a boy, and with three kids, one a boy.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
And next we talk with a listener in Oak Forest on line 4. Hi.
Hi. You were talking about cleaning bird feeders.
Yeah.
I have a metal bird feeder, you know, one of those where you can adjust the weight so if too heavy a squirrel or something gets on, it closes. I haven't kept food in it this year at all. What's a good way to clean it out now?
Mm-hmm. You can readily get inside. It has a mechanism for you to clean the inside.
Yeah,
okay.
the top whips out.
I tell you, the best cleaning method for any sort of bird feeder is hot, soapy water. And then just, you know, let it air dry or dry it out the best you can. You don't really need to use bleach or, you know, any disinfectant. Just hot, soapy water to remove most of any of the organic debris that's hanging around on it is going to be your best bet.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in McLean County on line 2. Hi.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
My question is, we have three dogs, and our oldest dog was almost 16 years old. She's part lab. About last month or so has decided she gets up in the middle of the night, and she'll bark and bark and bark or growl, low rumble growl. And so we kind of got her bed moved to the hallway, and so she'll... You get her back into the bedroom, and then she goes back out, and then she growls again, and then you do this whole thing about 3-4 times in the night, and I don't know what's going on with her. The thing we do notice is that she doesn't hear well anymore, and she has this white stuff in her eyes, and the vet didn't think she had cataracts yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure her smell has gone down some, too.
Mm-hmm.
Is any ideas on what to do for a dog who, I mean, she was one who slept through the night all the time, and I don't know what happened about the last 2-3 months. It's just like,
yeah.
Anyway, any thoughts, any suggestions?
Well, the white stuff that your veterinarian was talking about was probably just a change in the lens, and they can still see through it. It's called nuclear sclerosis of the ocular
right.
lens. So, you know, and that's something that's pretty typical in dogs as they age. What you're describing may very well be canine senility. It's something that we, in the past 10 years, have really started to look at as a real process that older dogs sometimes develop. And mm-hmm. and it's, you know, sometimes they lose the recognition of their owners. Sometimes they lose their housebreaking, their house training. Sometimes they just bark at nothing or will stare off into space or change their routine in some way. And
mm-hmm.
and there are a couple of products out there that have had some effect in sort of managing that process. But, you know, it's something that you would have to get through your veterinarian. But you know, look into canine senility, and it sounds a lot like what you're describing.
Okay.
Certainly, could it be other things? You bet. I mean, any sort of organic disease, like, certainly an older dog, we start to think more about cancer or liver failure or kidney problems. You know, any sort of organic disease can result in behavior change, but what you're describing really sounds familiar.
Yeah, because we had lab work done very end of December, and everything
looked good.
Yeah, everything looked really good. There was maybe one minor, I mean, it was so little, the difference was so little, it didn't even matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking probably just one thing.
Yeah.
And other than that, there wasn't. Oh boy, I never even thought about that for dogs.
Yeah. But there, like I said, there is a drug that was actually developed for an adrenal problem that turns out seems to be somewhat effective for canine senility.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
It'd be worth checking into.
Yeah, I think we will, because I haven't gotten sleep for the last couple of 3 weeks or months.
I'm sorry.
You know, it's just kind of strange. She gets up and barks.
Yeah, yeah, that's anyway. Tough, you know, and it's one of those things where you hate to sort of segregate them away from your sleeping area, but obviously you can't go forever without sleeping.
No, and you can't segregate her, because it doesn't matter where she is in the house, she'll bark.
She'll bark.
And she wants you to get her, come get her, literally, and walk her down to the bedroom, because she wants to be close, and then she gets up and wanders away.
Yeah.
So, I think you're right, because that does sound like, you know, old grandpa wandering away. So.
Anyway, it's tough to get old, you know?
It is, I know. Well, for me, too, but thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. You know, animals are, we're taking very good care of them,
mm-hmm.
by and large.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're living much longer lives, which is great for them and great for us, too.
Mm-hmm.
So is this field of mature animals within veterinary medicine, is that a field that is expanding?
Oh, absolutely. Geriatric medicine is a really big part of veterinary medicine. And, you know, we're really fortunate as veterinarians that we take care of animals from the minute they're born to the point of their death. And it's really a nice thing, because we can establish such great relationships with owners and with the pets themselves, but it's really tough to see them get old. And there are a lot of things, whether it's diet or medications or simply some behavior modifications that we can do to help our geriatric pets. But it is tough, you know, because they will go down.
Yeah.
Just like us.
yeah. And you know, one of my brothers had an issue with his dog that she got very, very old. And in order to manage the pain, they were giving her medication. Mm-hmm. And then the issue was, well, are we shortening her life mm-hmm. because we're treating the pain? And he said, treat the pain.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's that's another really important field, analgesia. You know, at the College of Veterinary Medicine, we have a service where that service will look at your pet's discomfort and modify a pain management protocol just for your pet. We also have a rehabilitation unit that's been a wonderful asset for the college, because cancer patients who are undergoing chemotherapy or animals who've had surgery, they can go in and they can work with the rehabilitator to really recondition themselves. And it's amazing what an effect that has, not only on the animal's well-being, but their mental outlook.
Yeah.
It's really impressive.
It is amazing that you have to, whether it's a cat or dog, those companion animals, they really need exercise and mm-hmm. play. Mm-hmm. And that makes them so much healthier. Yeah.
And it's nice because we can give a lot of instruction to owners who can continue that therapy at home and really have a nice interaction with their pets.
Yeah. Well, we're here at the end. Let's wrap up with... once again, Doodle for Art.
Doodle for Wildlife, yeah. Oh, we would really, really love it if the community could come out and support the Wildlife Medical Clinic. Like I said, you can certainly call and reserve tickets at 333-2762. That's area code 217. And it's going to just be a lot of fun. We have our students there. We've got a lot of really great prizes. It's going to be a live and silent auction and a lovely buffet dinner with some wine donated by Sunsinger. Many of the actual doodles themselves are not so impressive until Framers Market gets a hold of them, and they make them look fantastic. So yeah. I'm just really excited. It's going to be a fun event.
That's the 29th. That's this Saturday. And also Saturday, the Pet Stravaganza at the Stock Pavilion on the campus
Lots
of the
of fun.
U of I. So put in if you're on the web, put in University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine all kinds of interesting things there at the website. Dr. Whittington, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Julia